A generation or more ago, in 1977, the liberal Anglican bishop and theologian John A.T. Robinson published a small paperback book, Can We Trust the New Testament? Having considered in the various chapters aspects of the case, he came in the end, in his summing up, trustful faith, to a positive answer to the question posed. As the book cover of the book summarizes the position, Robinson's conclusion is that the New Testament can indeed be regarded still as a trustworthy guide to the words and work of Jesus the Christ. This book, therefore, does two things. It sorts out and places in context the various critical approaches to the New Testament, which have been made within the last half century, and it makes plain and gives reasons for the writer's own personal conviction as he emerges on the other side of all this tumult, that the New Testament is still the word of life. Now, 40 and more years on, I would claim in a broad perspective that Robinson was fighting an impossible rearguard action in defense of the indefensible. The true answer to Robinson's question has to be no. And I wish to spend this morning looking at some of the evidence which impels me to that different answer. Robinson's view that the New Testament can be regarded as a trustworthy guide to the words and work of Jesus the Christ not only begs an important question, but is, in the circumstances, an extraordinarily lukewarm endorsement. The words "can be regarded" are not a statement of unassailable factual proof. They even suggest that it is perfectly reasonable to hold a contrary position. And whatever the New Testament is, was Jesus as the Christ the central figure for the earliest disciples? Even Roman Catholic scholars have perforce come to the admission that in the early gospel source Q, Jesus did not see himself as Son of God in the conventional, in other words, developed Christian sense. And as I have many times pointed out, Professor Burton Mack, in his 1993 book, The Lost Gospel, The Book of Q and Christian Origins, takes this idea to its logical conclusion. The people of Q did not think of Jesus as a Messiah or the Christ. They did not take his teachings as an indictment of Judaism. They did not regard his death as a divine, tragic, or saving event. And they did not imagine that he had been raised from the dead to rule over a transformed world. Instead, they thought of him as a teacher whose teachings made it possible to live with verve in troubled times. Thus, they did not gather to worship in his name, honor him as a god, or cultivate his memory through hymns, prayers, and rituals. They did not form a cult of the Christ, such as the one that emerged among the Christian communities familiar to readers of the letters of Paul. The New Testament, therefore, as I never cease from pointing out, is two naturally opposing elements, lying, if truth be told, in uneasy juxtaposition or correlation. And these two opposing elements, once understood in all their stark simplicity, in fact clarify, because they represent, the long-standing divergence between the Christ of faith and the Jesus of history. Too much mainstream Christianity has accepted the Christ of faith as the centerpiece for living the Christian life. The upshot of that approach is that the Jesus of history tends to become an awkward embarrassment. Strauss and Renan and Schweitzer, all in varying degrees, courted difficulty and disdain in hitching their star to this wagon. If in Q, Jesus does not claim to be the Son of God, how is it possible for the developed theology of canonical John simultaneously to be original? John Robinson was himself acutely aware of this paradox. His very last book, largely completed at the time of his death, it was edited and seen through the press in 1985 by J.F. Coakley, was entitled The Priority of John. In it, Robinson made a bold fist of trying to advance the theory that many of the theological positions and emphases of the fourth gospel antedate their equivalents in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It is an impossible assignment, but at least Robinson had the honesty to realize that it is a primary question facing mainstream Christianity and to do his best to provide an answer, however ultimately inadequate. At last, the time has come which should be music to the ears of us Unitarians to emphasize as the centerpiece of living the Christian life not the Christ of faith, but rather the Jesus of history. Then a radically different Christianity emerges from the mainstream ruins. The Jesus of history, not surprisingly, is the true Jesus, a Jesus compatible in every particular with what Professor Burton Mack has written about the people of Q. And so the tables are turned. Rather than as proponents of the Christ of faith, having to underplay or even discard many of the incompatible intrusions of the Jesus of history, we now should have the courage to proclaim boldly that true Christianity must hold to the Jesus of history as primary, rejecting in consequence everything where the Christ of faith can be seen as supplanting or adding to what is factually or historically verifiable. The essence of the issue is thus the unity or otherwise of the New Testament record. Mainstream Christianity takes as axiomatic that the New Testament is a unity, and John Robinson is evidently, in his book, Can We Trust the New Testament?, a willing and accepting part of this tradition. Unitarians have historically understood the New Testament texts not as a unity, but as an amalgam of discrete elements. Let me give some concrete examples. In 1754, Isaac Newton published a small booklet two letters from Sir Isaac Newton to Mr. Leclerc. Republished by Watchmaker Publishing in 2011 as historical account of two notable corruptions of Scripture. Newton, with great thoroughness, sets out to show that the generally received text of the first epistle of John, chapter 5, verses 7 to 8, and of Paul's first epistle to Timothy, chapter 3, verse 16, have been deliberately and intentionally corrupted for theological motive. A more comprehensive working through of the implications behind this tendency came a generation later. The Reverend Theophilus Lindsay published in London in 1790 a book with the very long title, A List of the False Readings of the Scriptures and the Mistranslations of the English Bible, which contribute to support the great errors concerning Jesus Christ. Newton and Lindsay are making a most bold claim, which happens to be, we now can see, in essentials true, that the New Testament, or key elements of it, is or are a party political document designed above all with the intention of shoring up the edifice which has become the mainstream or establishment position. And the trend that Newton and Lindsay pinpointed in the 18th century has gathered pace and momentum during the course of the 20th. Again, let me give selective but important examples. In 1946, G.D. Kilpatrick published his book, The Origins of the Gospel According to St. Matthew, an analysis which constituted a devastating rebuttal of the concept of gospel unity. Kilpatrick showed how canonical Matthew had been brought together in a series of levels, with, for example, those places where ecclesia, church, appears in the text, representing a late level of accretion after the core text was already in existence. Then again, in 1964, A.Q. Morton and G.H.C. McGregor, in their book The Structure of Luke and Acts, subjected these two texts to computer analysis. The result of this process was their discovery that these texts were made up of two levels, to which they gave the descriptive headings Proto-Luke and the later Enlargement. A scientifically arrived at finding such as this completely blows away the pre-existing traditional view of the gospel as an inspired unity. The analytical work started by Newton and Lindsay in the 18th century now bears fruit which is determinant in its implications and confirms what was in earlier times merely the hypothesis that the gospel developed and grew in a series of incremental stages. One of those stages of growth was a calculated editorial progression beyond Christianity's Jewish roots. Let me give some examples. At Gospel of Thomas, 114, Mary Magdalene is referred to by the Hebraic form of her name, Mariam, which is also found as Mariam in fragments of the Gospel of Mani. We can be certain that the Hebraic form is original, being in time edited out by those who wish to give a less Jewish feel to the Christian record. And the process is repeated time after time for those who have eyes to see. In fragment 16 of the Gospel of the Nazareans, one of the Matthew family of Gospels, we reread, "And Jesus turned and said to Simon, his disciple, who was sitting by him, 'Simon, son of Jonah, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven.'" But in the canonical version of Matthew, the Judaic emphasis of Simon, Simon, son of Jonah, has been eliminated. And Jesus said to his disciples, "Truly, I say to you," and so on. Then again, an Aramaic expression originally used by Jesus and surviving in Mark, "Talitha kumi," maiden arise, has been removed in the versions of Matthew and Luke. Sometimes there is wider survival and sometimes more systematic elimination. Jesus' cry from the cross, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," my God, why hast thou forsaken me," survives in Aramaic, both in Matthew and Mark, but is missing in Luke and John. But the statement of Matthew, Mark, and Luke that at the time of the crucifixion, darkness covered all the land, is shown to be a de-Hebraizing of the original text by the version that survives in the Gospel of Peter. "A darkness covered all Judea." It seems certain then that the original Gospel would have contained a higher proportion of Hebraisms than have been allowed to survive in the canonical text. And there are also surviving Hebraic vestiges in the Acts of Philip, in speech involving Philip himself and Mary Magdalene. The more we venture into this territory of criticism and analysis, the more we are confronted with the patchwork nature of the canonical texts. As I suggested earlier, they are indeed, in effect, a party political document, a set of texts doctored and modified in the attempt to bolster the claims of the institution that emerged and consolidated itself in the second and third centuries. Getting behind this often misleading facade is now no simple task. Dr. Geza Vermes attempted it in his monumental 2003 book, The Authentic Gospel of Jesus. But this book is by no means a success, failing as it does to consider much of the important, in other words, non-canonical evidence. I gave my reasons for this assessment of Dr. Vermes's book in an address in March 2011, also published in Oscult. As a direct result, I myself attempted what I hope was an adequately thorough treatment, in other words, including the non-canonical evidence, in a series of 7 addresses plus epilogues entitled Types of Gospel, given in Blackpool in 2011. And it is the content of those 7 addresses plus epilogue which constitutes my primary reason for answering in the negative John Robinson's question with which we started: can we trust the New Testament? To sum up, the concept of the Christ of faith must now, on the whole, be cast aside as unjustified accretion. And a new historical reality must be constructed out of all the disparate sources itemized in my Types of Gospel series, a historical reality that seeks to build up the Jesus of history as far as that rebuilding is possible, which is now a very long way. That is why the correct answer to John Robinson's question has to be no. We cannot trust the New Testament. For this, in the light of our knowledge now, is the only credible and sensible approach for those concerned with recapturing the real religion of Jesus. Amen.